Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me today. I always find these introductions really strange, right? Because they generally say in cinema that when you are dying, your entire life flashes in front of you. And the introduction feels like that, right? Everything you have done is like flashing before you very quickly. But thank you so much for inviting me today. I met one of your colleagues, Mary, in Dortmund last year with a fantastic bunch of students who presented some incredible work. And I was just so blown off that when the invitation came, I said, I have to make it to Bochum. I have to see what the place is like. And I'm really, really excited to be here today. But I must confess that given that we live in a world of ubiquitous access and constant connectivity, I always get surprised to find real people sitting in real rooms coming to listen to real people talking from behind the stage. Because let's face it, it's about 6 in the evening, and you could be home right now doing this. Instead of that, you decided to come here and sit and talk with us. And while you are distracted by the Harlem Shake meme, and I hope that everybody in their life has at least once done the Harlem Shake. If you haven't, we do it at the end of the talk today, right? But while you're being distracted by it, let me make a fundamental proposition to you. I'm going to propose that somewhere in the last few years, without us knowing about it, in an almost non-dramatic fashion, we have foundationally changed our idea of who we are as information subjects, right? And I also want to make a disclaimer that I have stopped, or I promise to myself that when I address fellow researchers and students, I no longer present work that I have already done. So this is the first chapter of my new book that hopefully is coming out with Duke University Press. It's called The Disconnected Subject, hopefully. So I'm trying out an argument with you. It's not well-rounded, right? The corners have not been scrubbed very well. So please bear with me if it sounds choppy at some point, and I hope that we take it up in the Q&A to polish it together. So I'm going to treat all of you as my peer reviewers for today, right? And that will be interesting. Okay, so to go back to my proposition, that we have foundationally changed our ideas as who we are as informational subjects. What I'm going to do is give you a slightly elaborate historical snapshot of what informational subjects could mean with me. Bear with me if this sounds familiar. Feel free to keep on singing your favorite song in your head, and I will tell you when I'm coming back to the main argument. But let me rehearse this particular idea that we have always been informational subjects, right? That's something that's not alien to us. We understand who we are through production of information that we tie to ourselves, which is why, for example, authorship has become so important and fetishized, because we claim authorship over the information that we produce, and that one of the ways in which we understand ourselves is as authors of information. That doesn't mean that we need to publish. It doesn't mean that we need to have a proper channel where that information is being packaged, but we are aware of the fact that when I say something, it is an act of authorship, right? That I think of myself necessarily as a subject that produces information. It is also a given that we are subjects of information, which means that we don't need personal and social media to tell us that primarily when we talk about something, we talk about ourselves. Yeah? It's nice to think that information and communication are these glorified things where the best rarefied human knowledge is being produced, but it's also a given that largely most of our conversations are about what did you eat for breakfast? What do you think we're going to have for dinner? What do you think the weather's been like? And do you know what my dad told me yesterday? Right? There has been an incessant production of the personal that happens through communication. And I want us to be aware that we are then not just subjects of information, but sorry, we are not just subjects who produce information, but we are also subjects of information. And it is also a third given that we are indeed subject to information, which is to say that we are shaped by informational realities. We are continuously being written as feminist scholars like Judith Butler would have it, that we are continuously being written. She called it a creature, the act of being written. Our continuously being written selves, bodies, desires, and demands, which are constructed by the social, material, and informational realities which are around us. So it is this shift in the relationship with information that I want to signal. And I want to think of this relationship through the very abused, used, and often dismissed idea of an information overload. Now, it would be foolish to suggest that information overload is emerging as a concern for the first time. Mark Rose, who has this beautiful book called The History of Reading, talks about how the first debates in the libraries of Alexandria, where they had the first 300 books put together in a taxonomy, at the Library of Alexandria in 6th century, they were talking about how the 300 books need to be guarded because they thought that it was an act of information overload. Yeah, the official librarian was actually called the keeper of the books, and the librarian had to decide whether you should get access to these books because most people read less than one book in a lifetime. And generally that one book was the Bible. So Mark Rose kind of points out to you that information overload is not new. In fact, in 5th and 6th century AD, there were scribes who were employed to transcribe the Bible, right? The Holy Word had to spread. So there would be scribes, especially in England, who would be employed by the church and who would sit in cloisters, in dungeons, in really dank and dark situations, copying word by word the Holy Writ. And every time these scribes would leave the church, they would literally be frisked to make sure that they are not taking information outside the church and spreading it among the common man, because it was believed that the common man's access to this information would fry his brain and would lead to moral corruption. Yeah, that information overload was a concern in the 5th and 6th century when the first copying techniques were being built, which is largely handwritten copying that was being performed by the scribes. At the turn of the 16th century, and subsequently the introduction of movable type, had similar concerns, including Philip Sidney, the British poet and philosopher, talking about how difficult it is to write when you don't know who your reader is going to be. Sidney was very, very concerned that whatever wonderful information that he was producing might be too much to take for this unexpected, unknown reader, and that it might cause what he called moral paralysis for the reader. This is not very new for cinema studies students, right? We all remember how when the first film was shown of the train arriving on the platform, there were people who did not know how to consume cinema, and they thought the train was literally going to just get over them, and they ran out of their salons in Salon Paris, Salon India in Paris, and so on. In the 20th century, with the arrival of technologies of mass communication, but especially with the telephone, the anxiety was paramount. The capacity of somebody to just call you and give you information, spammers, cold callers, wrong numbers, strangers with predatory intentions, was just thought of as an informational state that people were not supposed to be able to handle. Carolyn Marvin, who is a historian of material technologies, in her fantastic book called When Old Technologies Were New, looks at editorials that came out in the New York Times to tell people how to use a telephone responsibly. And one of the most wonderful stories within that is how it was said that when you use a telephone, make sure that you keep the receiver at least 6 inches away from your face, because if the person on the other side has a flu, you might actually get sick, because along with the message, the flu might also travel through the line and make you infected. Right? These were real life editorials which were created as a way of coping with information overloads of certain kinds. And for those of us who are fortunately or unfortunately old enough to remember the Y2K scare, and I'm not sure how many people still remember what Y2K was supposed to be, but I have this beautiful video to show you about a Y2K commercial. So at the end of the year, at the turn of the millennium, for those people who were born in 2001, you don't know this, but at the end of the millennium, there was an imagination that the computer is going to stop counting time, right? Because our computer storage system was premised on two digits for the last year. And so after 99, it would go to 00. And when it goes to 00, it's going to be the end of the world. Here is a wonderful commercial that was put out for it. So that is Nike just doing a very, very funny take. But for a lot of us, this is what we were supposed to wake up to on 1st January 2000, right? The whole world gone awry because of the informational systems which are going to fail completely because they have lost the desire or the capacity for time. So I'm giving you this rather huge historical symptomatic overview to reinforce a simple fact that information overload is not a new phenomenon. Every technology that has sought to expand the scope of knowledge and increase the capacity to produce knowledge has always come with worries of how we shall deal with this massive amount of knowledge that we are going to be subjected to. The foundational shift that our contemporary states embody then is not that we are worried about information overload. You are exactly like your parents when you worry about information overload, right? The new condition is that we have actually stopped worrying about information overload. Or to make it simpler, we no longer think about information overload as that isolated moment when all systems collapse. We no longer think of information overload as that one day in a month when you have 100 emails waiting for you to be answered. We don't think of information overload as that one day that you come back from a vacation and you have 280 Facebook notifications and you don't know what to do. We have come now instead to say that information overload is not an exceptional state. It is not even something that we need coping mechanisms for. Instead, we seem to have accepted the fact that we are ontologically, informationally overloaded. That information overload has become such a naturalized state of being that we begin there. And we no longer think of it as a futuristic phenomenon or an exceptional condition that has to be dealt with separately. So if the older informational subject was a subject that was worried about information overload and how to escape it, the new informational subject is a subject that understands itself only through information overload. You begin your day with information overloads, right? I don't know how many of you sleep with your cell phones and wake up to it, but I definitely am guilty of it. The last thing recently, all I have been doing is looking at what Donald Trump said today, and then I wake up in the morning to look at what other people are saying about what Donald Trump said today, right? That's more or less all the information my day is sandwiched in. So I'm calling this older informational subject a narrative subject, and the new information overloaded subject, a data subject. And I want to map for us today this distinction between the narrative subject and the data subject in order to build a conceptual framework which might develop a vocabulary and a critical standpoint to address questions of politics and power. So I've not come to the end part of my argument. I'm still laying out the premise that there is an informational subject and a data subject. The informational subject was worried about coping with information overload, the data subject realizes herself by saying, I am informationally overloaded and I'm going to deal with it in a different way. Right? So there are two ontologically separate informational subjectivities to recognize. In the book, I hope to kind of mark a series of shifts which have happened from the information to the data self or the data subject. But I wanted to mention at least two specific marks or shifts which might be useful for us to think about. The first is the shift from representation to simulation. Yeah. So if the informational self was a representational self, the data self I'm proposing is a simulated self. And let me very quickly kind of just give you an inroad into looking at the shift. One of my most inspiring points of departure for thinking about representation and simulation is with Donna Haraway, who in her inspiring Cyborg Manifesto had suggested that simulation is a breakthrough moment where we no longer think about ourselves as morally bound to something that is out there. This shouldn't be too complicated for us. When we think about us as representational subjects, we believe that there is an authentic self and then there is an image that stands in for it, right? That the image has fidelity, has faithfulness, has certain kinds of appropriation of the exterior subject which is out there. And even in the 90s, Haraway was already talking about how we need to break from the tyranny of representation, which demands that every cultural object, every utterance, every sound, or every piece of information is representational in nature, and that there is a true and an authentic self which is behind all of those things. Yeah. So it might be interesting to figure out how we move away from the notion that the body is an accurate, authentic, and a culpable bearer of an exteriority that is not its own. For Haraway, representation continued to perpetuate difference, whereas simulation allowed for a difference without value. In order to make this particular argument more material, so that it's not just a conceptual trope, I do want to take you through very briefly through hardware computation. I don't know if there's anybody in the room who's ever built a computer. No? All right. In that case, please forgive me for the next 2 minutes. I'm going to sound like your computer science teacher that you never really wanted to listen to. Okay? But within the hardware computation, so not computing as a metaphor, but real actual computation, there is a very clear idea that a network is made out of nodes, right? And within social sciences and humanities, we are very used to thinking about how there are all these different nodes, and if we connect them, we build a network. Except that that's not how physical computation actually works. Physical computation says that a node is merely something that is activated in order to facilitate transfer of information from point A to point B. It's in fact really very poetic, because a network system looks at you and say, oh, you need to send information from here to here. In that case, imagine that this is a point, and I'm going to call it a node. This node is going to store information, and this node is now going to talk to this another thing, which I'm going to call a node, and the information is going to travel from here to here. Except that once the information transfer is done, the node collapses. Yeah? The node exists only as long as the transaction is taking place. The node is the first instance of a non-representational digitality. The node does not represent anything that's out there. The node does not pre-exist the action or the reality. The node has no subjectivity. And this is also why the internet is such a resilient network, because the minute one node is attacked or one node is collapsed, a million other nodes can be imagined and can replace one over the other. There is no such thing as an authentic node within a physical computation network. And so when we come to the question of data, we need to understand that the node has to be imagined as essentially simulation in nature. The information self, which was pre-digital, so to speak, was different. We insist even now that everything that a person says is unique, no matter if they use the same language and they're saying the same thing over and over again. So if right now I tell you things which are really wrong, you are going to hold me responsible for saying things which are really wrong because I am the producer of that information. I can, of course, always circumvent it and saying, but I am only referencing somebody else who did this really wrong thing. And so I'm not really the bearer. I'm only the amplifier of that information. But even within that broadcast mechanism system, there was a very clear idea that nodes in older networks or communication forms were uniquely different and identifiable. The data self, which is constructed through digital technologies and media, constructed through these temporary nodes, on the other hand, insists that most selves are identical with a few variables, which is different from saying the informational self, which insists that everybody is different with some common ideas together, right? So informational selves historically have said, we are all the same, we are all different and unique, each in its own individual capacity, and we form consensus or we form commonality to make meaning out of whatever it is that we are feeling. Whereas the digital self works the other way around. It begins by saying that whether you like it or not, you are entirely replaceable. That you are, in fact, nothing more than a common set of features with a few variables here and there. And that's the first shift I kind of want to chart out for the informational self to the database, to the data self in some ways. This might perhaps be best illustrated with this insane app, which I don't know if you come across in Germany yet, but it's called the Invisible Boyfriend. Has anybody heard of it? No? Not yet? It will come to you, don't worry. It's number three in the dating apps in the US in 2015. So the Invisible Boyfriend is this insanely strange app which allows you to create a profile for a boyfriend who will do everything to you that a real boyfriend does, except for meeting you. Yeah, it's perfect. It's basically you don't have to deal with the messy materiality of actual biology, but then that boyfriend will do everything that you want to do with him. So they will send texts to you, they will have long, prolonged WhatsApp conversations, they will like things that you put on Facebook and on Instagram. If you are having an awkward family dinner where you know that your parents are going to ask you, so, have you found yourself a man yet? You can even schedule for your invisible boyfriend to call you with a picture. And then you will talk to somebody in real life to tell your parents, saying, I'm talking to my boyfriend, leave me alone. Right? So most people signed up for this, and it had like 1.6 million users in the first 3 months of its launch. Most people signed up on it thinking that it's going to be actually just a piece of artificial intelligence, which is trying to talk to you, like Siri or Microsoft Stay or something like it. Except that they very quickly realized that they were speaking to actual human beings. This is where now things become really weird. Your invisible boyfriend, over a period of 1 month, can easily be more than 1,000 microworkers who are all pretending to be the same person talking to you. So the invisible boyfriend is nothing but an incredibly sophisticated algorithm which is able to take up your character personalities, your imagination of what you want from your boyfriend, and then continuously delegate tiny pieces of your boyfriend's activity to a range of 20,000 microworkers who are going to have continued access and of what your profile is, what you do, and continue conversations with you. But it's basically at an estimate, if you have a long conversation for about 25 minutes a day with your invisible boyfriend, you are in effect talking to at least 800 microworkers who are all pretending to be that one person. Now, this is interesting, but it gets weirder after this. Because what happens is that after about 6 months of the invisible boyfriends being around, there were two specific kinds of cases that started emerging. One, there were people who started going for therapy because they fell in love with their invisible boyfriend. Which isn't really funny. I mean, more than your mother, your shrink, or your real boyfriend, this is a boyfriend who's actually going to listen to everything that you say and remember everything that you say, because he doesn't have a memory, he has storage. Right? He does not have the capacity to forget, but he has the infinite capacity to retrieve information from you and simulate your most ideal relationships. So one of the things that we were trying out was having 6 different boyfriends, for instance, on this particular app. And you can also choose the characteristics of the boyfriend that you want. So if you want a forgetful boyfriend, you can have a forgetful boyfriend. And then when he forgets, you can shout at him and you can feel happy that this is exactly how your relationship is growing, right? In some ways. But so there were all these users who really started going for therapy because they thought that they had fallen in love with their invisible boyfriend, despite the fact that they knew how the mechanism is operating. Yeah? On the other hand, you had an even stranger phenomenon. We did interviews with 11 microworkers who opted out of working for the Invisible Boyfriend app because they said that they were working and having romantic relationships with so many people online that their own love life was deteriorating, that at the end of the day when they went home, they no longer wanted the physical touch or intimacy of the person that they were with, right? One of the people actually said it felt like I was having an affair with 600 women at the same time. And so when I went to my real girlfriend, the one I have in real life, I had nothing left to say or do with her. Yeah, I had used all my catchphrases. I had talked about 16 movies that have come out. I had discussed everything with all these people who I will never meet and I never know. So I was very curious about what this does to our notion of a simulated subject. Essentially what this particular phenomenon is kind of guiding us towards, and for me that was interesting just looking at it. So this is a conversation with Ryan where at some point somebody said, "Ha, man, you're better than my real boyfriend," and she really meant it, right? But what really is fascinating for us is that the payload of the algorithm is in ensuring that it matches users of enough people who are alike so that the conversations are seamless and the interactions are intimate. In the case of the invisible boyfriend, the data self infuses affective intimacies to technological protocols that simulate social orders which can no longer be fathomed or fashioned by human intentions or accidents. The distributed workers all become one human being. The individual users all become distributed selves. And what they have is no longer a cause and effect linearity relationship with information, but a distributed data set that continues to simulate human relationships as opposed to represent human relationship. Right? The invisible boyfriend is not a representational structure. Each microworker is a replaceable node. Each individual user is only getting customized, tailor-made, specific details and conversations that she is subscribing to, and that is all there is to it. The new data self in this specific model is broken down, is not tied to linear, causal, correlated, or time-based narratives or structures of dependence. Instead, the new data self is broken into atomic structures and microscopic data streams, which can be mixed and matched to form infidel and bastardized versions of the information self, giving the subject almost no agency, choice, or control, except for following the script that the algorithm's throwing for her. The data self then needs to be always connected and always be generating traffic. And hence the data self often comes up as an answer to the humanist crisis of what are we going to do next. The data subject is an informationally overloaded subject because its only existence in a system like the invisible boyfriend is in a continuous harvesting of data. So we also tried experiments of what happens if you do have an invisible boyfriend and then if you refuse to speak with them. That's not possible. You have to give almost unlimited access to your phone, to your calendar, to all your social media for your material to be continuously harnessed and harvested so that the invisible boyfriend can speak with you. But we did try it out once where we created an account, started talking, and then for 3 months we refused to open that account at all. The microworker, however, earns her money largely out of just sending conversations. And so after 3 months, we opened our account to find like 800 messages which are continuously worried about, "Hey, honey, how are you doing? What are you up to? You're not responding to my messages. Do you want me to call you? Are you okay? I checked with your friends. You seem to be active on Facebook," and so on and so forth, right? So even without meaning to, they performed a beautiful rejected lover who just doesn't give up. And we were wondering when this is going to turn really creepy. Right? How long is it going to take saying, "Send you a message saying, get the signal, dude, this is not happening," right? But this notion of the simulated self kind of is kind of illustrated for me within this paradigm. So the second shift I wanted to kind of quickly gesture towards is one that's familiar to you, but I wanted to denaturalize it for us. And that's the shift from the analog to the digital. And I think it's necessary to understand exactly the difference between these two, because very often digital and analog are used as descriptive words, whereas they are actually philosophical concepts, right? So you see digital anything. These days, almost everything is digital. I actually have digital socks, by the way. I don't know if you know about digital socks. No? No? Haven't you come across digital wearables yet? These are socks which send a message to my app when they become too smelly. So apparently, you know, I no longer have a nose and I don't have to depend on it, but my socks actually send a warning message saying your socks are going to be smelly, so it's time to throw them into the washer. All right? This is the internet of everything. Not just internet of things, but the internet of everything. Anyway, so the common sense perception is that that which is available in binary code or electronically is digital, yeah? Whereas that which is available in material forms is analog. And the standard example given to computer science 101 is that a hammer is a digital object, whereas a computer is, the hammer is an analog object and the computer is a digital object. Except that anybody who is interested in material technologies knows that if you go to IKEA today and you try and buy a hammer, that hammer has been touched by the digital in unexpected ways. From sourcing material and alloys in deep southern Africa to the transport of it, to making sure that it's barcoded, it's constructed, it's assembled, and so on, there is a series of digitality which is involved, but it's hidden. Its performance is not in the final object, but in the process of making. For all of us who have had to throw away a laptop because it refuses to reboot or because the motherboard is fried, we know that it can no longer be thought of as a digital object, right? A dead laptop is merely junk. It's just a series of plastic wires, silicon chips, and so on and so forth, but it's not really digital per se. And so it might be important to make the distinction about what exactly is a digital condition. And we move from the object to the condition to understand the digital and the analog. My favorite example to talk about digitality is to go back to the hand. So I don't know if it's true in German, but in English, the fingers are also called digits. Yeah, are you aware of the Latin root, the digitus, right? Digits. Does anybody know why the fingers are called digits? It's way before the digital started, right?
Because you use them for counting?
Absolutely. You do use them for counting, but remember that the notion of the fingers is way before counting. Yeah. The fingers called the digital because your hand is actually analog. Your hand cannot be divided, cannot be measured into different units, and your hand is not subject to manipulation. Your bones are not flexible. The fingers, on the other hand, is the ability to splinter the analog object into multiple different data sets, which can, of course, count. But remember, if we take evolutionary biology seriously, this is the only reason we are different from chimpanzees, right? That we have opposable thumbs. So digital actually is a condition of manipulation, segmentation, fragmentation, and counting. Yeah? So that anything that is analog can turn digital if it's allowed to be broken into discrete pieces which can then be counted. Whereas the analog is essentially that which is fused together so that it cannot actually be broken into different pieces. The analog is individual in terms that it is not divisible. And our notion of the informational self, at least the post-enlightenment informational self, has been of the self as an individual, right? That which cannot be divided. Whereas the digital self, which makes itself manifest through these different kinds of data sets, can be divided into discrete, measurable units, which can then be put together into specific different kinds of constellations. Take, for example, the ways in which the human has been conceptualized in biological sciences. I've been doing a whole bunch of work with people who are geneticists, people who are looking at informatics sciences, and so on. So in the late 20th century, biological sciences had a very straightforward conception of the human body, that the human body is a complete whole. Right? You might have separate parts, but that each part is affected by all the other parts which are around it. And so if you need to become a medical doctor, you first need to understand the general body, and then you need to specialize in one specific element of that. The human body biologically was thought of as one discrete system which cannot be broken down into bits and pieces, which is why if you go to a doctor, no matter what your ailment is, they are trained professionally to first look at your pulse, then look at your eyes, then listen to your heartbeat, So isn't it weird that the prognosis begins the same? If you go and say, I have a headache, and if you go and say, I think I have broken my leg, they still do exactly the same processes in order to go through the final root cause, and that's because the biological sciences thought of the body as a whole. With geneticists and with informatic scientists, this is completely different now. So Rashmi Prasad, who is a genome mapping scientist who sits in Malmo,
Or tells me the fascinating story of how you can mark the difference between the informational subject and the data subject by looking at the notion of the I. That within the informational subject's paradigm, the I was something that has been crucial to the development of the human being. Especially for those of us who do media and cultural studies, we know how looking, vision, seeing, focus has been so much a part of our vocabulary of civilization, of politics, and so on and so forth. Within data sciences, the eye is thought of as an accidental organ for excretion. The only reason you need really eyes is because the eyes are the only ways by which the toxins around your brains can be released. And so your brain doesn't actually become poisoned by all the bile things that our own bodies produce. Which is why the geneticists will argue that a fetus which is born without sight, right? A child that is born without the power of seeing will always live. But the child which cannot open its eyes is going to die at the state of the fetus because it has no other forms of excreting the poisons that its own body is producing. Prasad gives me this particular example to say that this is a new conception of the biological. She also, Esha Shah, who is another historian of the genetic material, tells us that the gene that we were all taught in school is the fundamental thing that defines the human being is actually a lie. When the gene was being discovered, there was no standardized patterns, there were no standardized data sets, it was not a naturally occurring thing. But the 23 scientists or biologists who basically came up with the model of the gene and eventually got the Nobel for it, I was going to say Oscar because it's such a great performance, right? But they actually did perform the myth of the gene to comply to the individuated body of the informational self. That they were so tied into the idea that the body is individual that we are all essentially same and connected in different ways, that they literally fabricated this thing called the gene, which doesn't exist. Any genetic scientist will tell you that the gene is a myth. That at the end of the day, it is just a completely random set of data, which is being naturalized by one algorithm that these 23 scientists brought together. And they insisted that this is the gene that is in place. Right? So I'm kind of curious about this specific conception of the human as it shifts from the digital to the analog, and the analog and the digital, and how we want to make a difference between the I and the I over there. And now I reach my final argument, if this particular shift is clear. So I'm going to take a small pause, and I know I'm throwing like a huge rush of arguments towards you, but is the distinction now clear, or are the shifts clear from the information self to the data self? Yeah? I mean, I'm sure there are like a million loopholes and we can leave them for later. But if you are with me here, then I can actually take you into real life politics of what happens when we take this shift seriously. Let me begin by talking about a specific story from India, which might help consolidate this thing much better for us. So has anybody heard of internet.org? It's one of those weird things that happens to 38 countries in the global south, but we don't need to hear about it. Right? It's not reached Europe yet, but you're going to get it. All right. So internet.org is a consortium, a not-for-profit consortium that is primarily owned by Facebook, but has other collaborators like Apple, Samsung, Microsoft, Google, and so on and so forth. Internet.org helps conceptualize a specific kind of data subject, which basically says that all the evils in the world will be cured if all of us merely got connected to the internet. And this is not a new rhetoric. For anybody who has looked at information and communication technologies for development portfolio, we know that connectivity is the solution for everything, from HIV/AIDS to terrorism to what have you. If only everybody came online, we are going to resolve all the problems in the world. So internet.org takes up this data subject in a very specific way and goes to countries which cannot afford digital infrastructure and says that we will give free internet to every citizen in your country, and that's our mission, right? To have the entire world connected on the information highway.
Now, if you look at it, and if you are a big fan of Facebook like I am, you're like, oh, really? You're going to give internet to free for everyone? And Zuckerberg's been traveling all across the global south trying to do this. They have also been coming up with lots of campaigns in India about how, you know, we should support digital equality, everybody should have equal access, and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is that they will give free internet as long as they can define what the internet means. Or very simply, they have a list of 30 websites that they have selected, and these are the websites that will be available to the next billion people who are going to come online for free. This is not a censorship argument, right? They're not doing what your university does. Like right now, if you're bored and you're trying to download pornography, you're most probably not going to be able to access it on EduRoam. Or your IT administrator is going to send you a message saying, hello, did you forget where you are? Right? So it's not censorship, it's not filtering. It's literally saying that we will define what the internet is going to be. And if on our connection you try to access anything else, you will have to pay extra for it. There are 30 websites. Do you want to make a guess of how many free websites or open websites were in that list? One. It was Wikipedia. Right? All the other 29 websites were actually predefined in some ways. Now the thing is, in order for internet.org to do this, they would have to break one of the most foundational treaties that the internet was signed on, which is called net neutrality. Net neutrality is the foundational principle that was signed on by the Global Consortium of Digital Connectivity in 2001, which essentially says that our traffic is always going to be non-discriminatory in its delivery. So whether you are here trying to download pictures of cute cats, or you are trying to download Hegel because that's what you need to read for your bedtime, the point is that your service provider cannot discriminate based on the quality of the content, whether you will have preferential access to the content or not. In order for internet.org to implement this particular policy, what they have been doing across the world, in Chile, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Tanzania, in Uganda, in Kenya, in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and so on and so forth, they have been lobbying for each government to opt out of net neutrality, which allows them then to define what the data subject is actually going to consume and where she is going to be able to reside. This is a specific form of data subjectivity that kind of is really interesting to me. Fortunately, in India, there has been an entire year long of political battles and legal fights around it. And right now, the government of India has banned free basics in our country. But that's not true of 32 other countries that they are operational right now. Now, I don't want to go into the politics of big, bad and evil Facebook, but I do want to talk about what this means to us in terms of thinking about the data subject, this ontologically, informationally overloaded subject that I began the talk with. What I'm suggesting to us is that this particular conception of the data subject that Facebook and internet.org are trying to provide for us emerges out of two pre-wired responses which we have naturalized when faced with information overload. Yeah? All of us, especially within humanities, cultural studies and media sciences, when we are faced with questions of data not being clean or not being intelligible, give largely two responses. One response is that the data is not clean enough and we just need to get better quality of data, more data, a larger sample of data, and once we have all of that, we are going to be able to scrub it and we're going to make intelligent arguments around it. This is what digital humanities is doing. I'm kind of glad it's not yet caught on in Germany. But digital humanities is one of the most insidious forms by which critical humanities is being translated to be data scrubbers for the likes of Facebook and Google, where we are merely giving them cleaner and better data because we have believed in the fact that being data subjects is actually going to lead to equality and egalitarian societies. The second response to this specific problem of information overload is actually that we are really scared. Right? You do realize that there is so much being written in your tiny field of expertise that you are never going to complete your thesis if you start reading everything that's being written. For the first time, we are encountering and resigning ourselves to the fact that information is being produced in such a large volume that the only thing that can make sense of it is non-human algorithms. Right? From search engines which are going to recommend which books you read, to Amazon which is going to tell you what books to buy,
to different people who are going to just recommend based on Reddit like likes or different kinds of upvoting systems, you know that you have already gone way beyond the point where you can be an intelligent connoisseur of knowledge in your field. Because you can build a bibliography right now, and I swear all the professors in the room, each one of us will come and tell you what exactly you are missing in it, and we might not have common books to share for that. Right? So when we are faced with this kind of idea that the human spectator is not the sacred audience to the knowledge which is being produced, we have the second pre-wired response, which is to say that we need better tools to mine the information that we are being subjected to. That as data subjects, we are essentially going to continuously annotate, give different kinds of metadata, and keep on cleaning up different kinds of,
making different kinds of recommendation systems, which are going to then produce resistance. And this is where I want to kind of end the talk today and come to the disconnected subject. That in this shift from the informational subject to the data subject, what we have generally focused on is a binary that we have disciplinarily been very, very complicit in producing. We produce the binary of the unconnected subject and the connected subject. Yeah? Connectivity is a fetish when it comes to media and communication sciences right now. We necessarily think that the only thing to do with an unconnected subject is to connect her. Right? So if you look at, and it's so phenomenally absurd, because you literally now start thinking in this technologically connected paradigm and talk about how it's no longer a first world versus third world problem, it's not the global north versus the global south, but it's literally the digital divide. People who are connected and people who are unconnected. Yeah? And we suggest that the only way by which we are going to give power, give voice, or give empowerment of different kinds is by connecting the unconnected subject onto the information highway. And my proposition to you is that that used to work for the informational subject, but it does not work for the data subject. Because if you agree that the only way to build equal and egalitarian societies is by connecting people online, then you are actually promoting the kind of world that internet.org wants to build. Because it basically means that you will have to be now legible, intelligible, and accessible to algorithms and companies which want to harvest you for your data. And the disconnected subject for me is a new thing. The disconnected subject is a perversion where you can be connected without complying to the demands of connectivity. Yeah? The disconnected subject is a very cyborgian figure where it essentially is saying that I am neither nor, but also. Which is to say that I am not necessarily a connected subject available for data harvesting for anybody who wants it, nor am I a disconnected subject who has to be off the grid and has no access to the information highway. But I am a connected subject who can exercise her rights not to be connected when I don't want to be. And I am also a disconnected subject because when I choose to do that, I exercise an agency which you will have to grant me. To be private, to be anonymous, and to be incognito. So the idea that I have with the disconnected subject is essentially particularly that. That it can work with these four kinds of corners where we let go of the older informational self categories which we have been used to in thinking about empowerment or thinking about equality and start developing a new vocabulary and a framework which will have to deal not with either silent or with a voice, not with either oppressed or the oppressor, not with either connected or unconnected, but disconnected. Somebody that appropriates connectivity and perverts it, uses it counterintuitively, and uses it as the new vocabulary of poetics and the new politics of resistance from which we can start speaking again to questions of social justice and political action. Yeah? I'm going to end here and then hopefully we get into more conversations. But yes, thank you very much. Thank you.